A Waikato Thing, Episode 2, Part 1, Volcano.
I was in Tauranga driving through Te Puke. How I remember it so well, because the streets are so wide in Te Puke. Parked up, walked across the street, got me an ice cream, came, and the time I thought, wow, there's some dark clouds, it must be pouring down at home. And so by the time I came out of the shop with my ice cream, I never made it to the truck without it being covered in ash. Ko Tongariro te maunga, ko Rotaira te moana, ko Te Pararangi te tangata, ko Bob Smith ahau. Kia ora, my name's Bob Smith, a local born and bred. I always kind of say to everyone, I'm a dishwasher from a little marae that sits at the foot of Tongariro. Like everyone, I suppose, have a role, lived here basically all my life. Around the national park, our role is to care for the place first, so putting the place at the forefront before us. We quite often hear that people come away from the mountains and say, oh, I just love these mountains because it gives me this, that and the other, that solitude, that peace and that on there. We always kind of talk about, well, what do you give back to the mountain? And so that's kind of more around them taking responsibility when they're here, respecting the mountain or the mountains and that, and the park in general, having respect for the place. We see it as a living, breathing entity, and it's kind of really reflective. So, you know, in the UNESCO with the World Heritage. So prior to 1993, all of the cultural sites, listed sites in the world, were all man-made. So Te Whareto fought for a number of years to have sites listed as cultural sites that are not man-made. So it's not the Taj Mahal, it's not the, you know, those kind of buildings that have been made by men. But we believe that cultural sites can also be sites that have been created by nature, and certainly the volcanism has kind of shaped Tongariro National Park as we see it today, and it will still keep evolving. 95-96, so the biggest thing I remember about it was my mate in Australia ringing his mum in Tūrangi, because the reports they got was that half the North Island's blown apart. My friend's mum was out in the garden for 3 days doing the garden. When she finally answered the phone, he said, oh, mum, you know, how he's getting on and that on there? He's still alive and that. And she goes, oh, wait, what happened? He said, oh, the mountain blew up and that. And I said, oh, geez, I never saw anything, heard anything and that on there. So over that 95-96 period, I think there's, tell me if I'm wrong, 117 different eruptions in that 18-month period, something like that. Two 2012 eruptions, so got a call during that eruption, rang Harry Keyes from the Department of Conservation. This was about 11:45 at night. Said, Harry, get out of bed. Mountains erupted. He said, oh, have we got any confirmation from GNS? I said, no, not yet, but I'm on the other phone talking to locals who are watching red things for flying through the sky. So he thought, shit, it is blowing up. So his job was to ring GNS and my job was to ring police to start getting the group together.
We monitor the volcanoes through the Volcano Monitoring Group attached to GeoNet at GNS Science, and we have a wider New Zealand Volcano Science Advisory Panel that brings in representatives of all of the agencies for understanding volcanic processes, or if we've got volcanic unrest or an eruption, to provide the right expertise. Kia ora, I'm Graham Leonard. I'm the lead scientist for Natural Hazard and Risk at GNS. When we're not dealing with an event, we've got advisory groups. We have advisory groups focused on Auckland, on the Calderas, over at Taranaki, and also focused on the cone volcanoes in Tongariro National Park. And these bring together iwi, emergency management, infrastructure, and scientists to together plan for the response that we'll one day need when there is an eruption.
In New Zealand, for communicating the state of our volcanoes, we use the New Zealand Volcanic Alert Level System. This is a numerical system. It runs from 0 through 5. I'm Brad Scott. I'm a volcanologist and currently I work with GNS Science. 0 is a volcano that's quiescent, quiet. It's like Rotorua, where we are today. You can walk up to the volcano, put your hand on it, you can put all the scientific toys on it, and you cannot find any reason that the volcano is active other than some geothermal features. Volcanic Alert Level 1 and Volcanic Alert Level 2 are volcanic unrest. That's when you take your equipment to the volcano and you can measure something that says there is molten material or magma associated with the volcano. It might be volcanic gases, it might be earthquakes, volcanic tremor, all sorts of different signatures from the volcano. And then Volcanic Alert Level 3, 4 and 5 are small, moderate and large volcanic eruptions.
My name is Sally Potter and I'm a senior social scientist at GNS Science, located in Tauranga, where I'm sitting on the sunny waterfront at the moment. So I want to tell you a little bit about what goes into our volcanic activity bulletins, which we put out at GNS Science through the GeoNet monitoring program. Whenever there's a change in activity at the volcanoes or just an update that we need to be able to share. So if you have a look at those, they're on our GeoNet website. You might be able to notice that in that information, we have a short summary of what the volcano is up to. We have the volcanic alert level and we have the aviation color code. Now, looking behind the scenes on how we produce these, every Monday morning, we have a volcano monitoring meeting. So we discuss what the volcanoes are up to. We look at the monitoring data coming in from our sensors. We discuss what might be happening beneath the volcano. And then we talk about what communications we need to do about that. Now, these communications are aimed at the emergency management sector, the regional councils, Department of Conservation, all the agencies that are in those areas, but also to the public who live in those areas. So anyone who's interested can look at them. Now, those are relatively new, putting them into bulletins. And there's only a small handful of occasions that we've been able to do it so far. We did create them during the Taupo unrest in 2022 to 2023, mainly just to the stakeholders. We've also done them for Ruapehu's unrest in 2022 and immediately following the Whakaari 2019 eruption to try and help inform the response decisions going on there. So we're working to improve our capabilities in this area and to communicate them more frequently. And to me, this is really important because it empowers people to make those decisions before the event occurs and get ready for it and hopefully change actions as required to keep themselves and other people as safe as possible.
I'm at Whakapapa Ski Field on the northern flank of Ruapehu Volcano, sitting on what once would have been a scorching hot lava flow making its way down the volcano during an eruption, one of the many eruptions that have formed this giant mountain we see. I'm volcanologist Dr. Janine Krippner, and I work on volcanoes just like this one in New Zealand and overseas.
In this region, you might see what you've been taught in school. You'll see the big stratovolcanoes and composite cones, the big calderas, the smaller scoria cones. If you go north up to Auckland, you'll see the monogenetic volcanic field, where we have a lot of smaller cones and lakes and craters that have only erupted once, except for Rangitoto. As a volcanologist, it's our job to unravel the landscape, to understand the range of eruption styles from the smaller lava flows, what we call the effusive eruptions, to more explosive styles that produce volcanic ash, which forms by magma being ripped apart by the gases within the fluid, violently expanding, just like shaking a bottle of Coke and then taking the cap off. With volcanic ash that will be blown by the wind direction at the time, dominantly that's towards the northeast, but in February 1975, when Narahoi erupted, my family, my grandparents, my uncles, were looking at volcanic ash falling on their farm in Patarangi, just south of Hamilton. So this wind direction can also take volcanic ash to places we might not normally think of.
I have a photo of my uncle's little handprints with 1975 on the side of the house.
I remember the 75 eruption of Ngāru Hui, and then on there. Biggest thing was walking downtown as a kid, one of the cousins, they were painting their roof. That morning, the ash dropped on the roof, and because of the big, thick lead-based paint, all the ash just stuck to the roof. So they thought, oh, well, you know, we'll just leave it there. Probably should have taken it off straight away, because within about 18 months, they had leaky roofs and had to replace the whole roof.
When we think about volcanoes, we think about a dramatic landscape and the processes that are most visually stunning. We often think about lava flows or explosive eruptions with flying rocks. And there's a lot of life safety hazard attached to those if you're close to a volcano when they happen.
And there's some good video footage of people running away from the mountain, and always kind of say to them, you actually face the mountain and just keep an eye on ballistics. And then I know it's going to be hard to dodge, but that's more the better thing to do than just turn your back to the mountain and run down.
There's a lot of life safety hazard attached to those if you're close to a volcano when they happen. But globally, we've realized the most common disruptive and costly hazard is volcanic ash. So we want to talk about that for a little bit. Ever since the 95-96 eruption sequence at Ruapehu, we realized ash can distribute across large swaths of the North Island and even into the South Island. And we've spent a lot of time studying the last 20 to 25 eruptions around the world that are similar to what we might see. What we've discovered globally is the most common anxiety around eruptions is volcanic ash, and whether it might affect your health, breathing the ash, or drinking water that's got ash in it. And our take home on that one is ash is more of a nuisance and a disruptor than a critical life safety risk. But there are some things you need to know. It's important when you're seeing ash fall to shelter indoors. Close your windows, close your doors, close the pet flap, try and keep the pets from going in and out while the ash is falling. It is mildly abrasive. It can make you cough and sneeze. It can be an aggravating factor for people with pre-existing respiratory conditions and actually be a real risk for those people. They need to keep that in mind. Like any effect on their health, they need to follow the advice of their usual medical practitioners. They definitely need to shelter, take their usual medications. But the wider population, sheltering in place and nuisance effect is the main part of breathing or potentially breathing ash. You don't need to evacuate from it. If it lands on roofs or gets into open water supplies coming from rivers or onto roof catchments into tanks, ash can contaminate drinking water, but it's very unlikely to be a short-term health risk. It can make the water taste bad, but the number one priority is we don't want people stopping drinking water or stopping hygiene and washing because there's ash in the water, because that's an even bigger risk. And a really important point here is your primary advice around health is New Zealand health authorities. We've learned these lessons from other places in the world, but you will be getting advice from your New Zealand health authorities. Beyond health, we see internationally people have not planned for having to clean up ash. And beyond a few millimeters that can be of thickness, that can be quite a task. We need coordinated planning by local government, a way for people to clean up their properties, get it in one place. We need to think about where it's going to be disposed. Ash can also disrupt major pieces of infrastructure. At the top of that chain is electricity. Ash can coat insulators and cause flashover, especially on the very high voltage lines. Our electricity providers are aware of this, and we work with them on advice. They can clean those lines. It can also affect switchyards and transmission yards. It's important for people to be aware you could find yourself for a period without electricity during ashfall, especially heavy ashfall. And other parts of your daily life and your system may be dependent on that. If you're without power, you might not have a water pump. You might, if you're on a farm, have a bunch of systems that rely on power that you can't rely on. If you're running infrastructure, a lack of electricity can also lead to a lack of water pumping, for example. And then ash can also affect water treatment and water supplies. So we work closely with critical infrastructure to talk about those impacts and make plans for them. But at home, you just need to be aware you could have disruption to those infrastructure supplies. People may be quite concerned about health. You'll get advice from your official source through health, and generally ash is more of a nuisance that you're sheltering from than a major concern from a life safety point of view. On the day when there's been an eruption and there might be ash on the way, or there's unrest at a volcano and you're hearing that there might be the potential for an ash eruption, it's useful to have looked at the resources and information on what ash can do and how you can protect yourself ahead of time. Have a look at the links provided with this podcast. You can also go to gns.cri.nz/ash as a one-stop shop for all the resources you might need. There's a lot you can do to be prepared ahead of time, and it's useful for you to know where those resources are so you can quickly see what the better actions to take during ashfall are. And if you do run a farm or you're involved with large infrastructure, there's a lot of extra advice around how to prepare for and deal with ash when it's affected those industries. When we think about volcanic ash and the Waikato and other agricultural regions, there can be really notable impacts from ash to crop-based agriculture and also livestock. It tends to get worse with thicker and more prolonged ash. Ash falls of a few millimeters often have relatively low effect, but ash that gets into centimeters and especially tens of centimeters when you start to bury crops and bury pasture can be really notable. Animals, especially sheep who graze close to the ground, can find themselves eating a large amount of ash, and that can be quite a risk to the animals themselves. And also if they lose their feed through burial, alternative feed, and livelihood becomes an issue. And then there's the wider consequence from other bits of infrastructure that need to be kept in mind. If you lose power at a farm or your water supply has a lot of ash in it, that could have other consequences that you weren't expecting. Ash can also get onto crops and be a problem or a concern that it's worth thinking about ahead of time. Ash generally has a low impact on root crops or on the inside of peelable fruit and vegetable, but people might be quite concerned. Whereas if you're eating a leafy crop or a fruit or a vegetable where you can't peel it, you really need to wash the ash off before you consume it. And that can affect saleability, and it can also affect international marketability if people are worried about the ash impact to the fruit, vegetables that have come into contact with ash. And that's part of a partnership that is ongoing amongst us and the science community and the Ministry of Primary Industries and other key players in the agriculture industry.
So definitely here in the Central North Island, we welcome people with open arms and that on there. But we do ask them to respect the place as well as respect themselves. And so what I mean from that is that know your limits, go prepared. It's in a wide open world and that on there, and there's a lot of climatic changes that happen during the day. So being prepared for those volcanic eruption as such is not something to frown upon and demonise and that on there. So quite often we do get, if there's an eruption, it's always kind of portrayed as something bad. We, for instance, celebrate an event of an eruption. So it just reminds us that, hey, as mere humans, and that we're only a smidget on this earth and that on there. And the power, I suppose, of Mother Nature's much more than us. So it's how do we learn to, survive in the area with Mother Nature, not against.
As a science communicator, one of my goals is to help people see that it's really us living with the volcanoes. They're not these giant monsters or these hazards that we need to fear. Yes, they can be devastating. Yes, they can have catastrophic impacts for communities and individuals. But they're an integral part of life on this planet. And the more we learn about them, the more we understand the warning signs they give us, the more we can understand how to better prepare ourselves, how to get out of the way, and how to be better prepared to recover from the eruptions that have formed this landscape to begin with. Growing up in Aotearoa, in love with this landscape, and then moving overseas for over a decade, every time I came home, coming down to these volcanoes has always been a mixture of excitement, of passion, of coming home, of this inner peace knowing I'm where I belong. But my experiences since I was a little girl have given me a sense of urgency. I've seen firsthand the damage that volcanoes do to communities and the stress and trauma that it causes when we don't understand the actions we need to take in order to protect ourselves with these incredible processes. Bringing that international experience back to New Zealand, looking at eruptions that could be similar to what we could see here, there's so much we can learn in order to help our communities. And we really work thinking this could happen soon, this could happen in our lifetimes, even if that's really probably not likely. Having that sense of urgency mixed with the passion of loving the landscape really drives a lot of us to spend our entire lives working to understand how they work.
My research is quite varied, but you know, to be able to understand volcanic hazards and provide useful outputs, as the government would say, around volcanic hazards, it has to be multidisciplinary, transdisciplinary as well. And so while the major focus of our research might be about figuring out ways to forecast future behavior and activity around volcanoes, we need to draw upon a whole range of sources of information, from geological records to statistical models to computational simulations. But in drawing upon a range of sources of information, models and methods and techniques, we took a leap probably about 20 years ago, and deciding that it was really important that we incorporated Mātauranga Māori as a source of information and data as well into our models and into the way that we do things, because we have to find solutions for the communities that live around our volcanoes, and so those communities have to be incorporated into every aspect of our research. And so that started me on the journey of looking at our Mātauranga around our volcanoes. It's also been a personal thing from where I come from as well. The reason that I think it's really important to incorporate Mātauranga into our solutions is because our local knowledge around our landscapes, around our lakes, around our volcanoes is a lot more detailed and in-depth than some of the geological engineering knowledge that's out there. And I've seen for years how even members of my own family have very detailed knowledge and information about changes in the environment that's just overlooked when it comes to developing solutions.
And science is also just one knowledge system, and it sits alongside other knowledge systems. It sits alongside Mātauranga Māori. It's important that we don't conflate science and Mātauranga Māori, and that talking through Mātauranga Māori and science beside each other and looking at the similarities and difference can often give us insights into interesting things to learn from each knowledge system and give mana to each knowledge system without one having to be better than the other.
Geology and volcanology is about understanding, observing and understanding the world around us and the changes that occur, and trying to forecast some of those changes. To do that, you need long records, a lot of information. And in New Zealand, Māori have been on this land for over 1,000 years, have an in-depth, intimate understanding of the way our landscape's changed.
In our whakapapa, in the language of our ancestors, we had three particular words for the volcanic activity around. And so one of them was puia, or the hot springs, or the geyser type hot steam that comes from deep within the land. And then we have Whakaari, and Whakaari was in a similar vein, but it was actually the the volcanic rivers that are subterranean. And you can sort of see, if you map the Ngātoroirangi's and his sister's visitation from Hawaiki, when he was stuck up on Tongariro Maunga, and he called out to his sisters to bring the heat, and they sort of, and you can almost see a direct line coming through the Moana into the land, and where the volcanic activity sprung up right through to Tongariro. So Whakaari is not just White Island, but it was named for that volcanic activity. And then we have Ruapehupehu. So Ruapehu is a major mountain in the volcanic plateau. But Ruapehupehu means the rua, or the hole, that comes from where comes the pehupehu, or that that heat and that hot, not only water but steam and things like that as well. Tū te rangi e tū, tū te papa e takoto, tū ia ratu ko wehe ki te pō uriuri, ki te pō tangotango, ki te pō he o tia tuai. Ko rā hui papa tōku ingoa, all the way from Tainui Waka. My ancestors travelled here on Tainui Waka, and the basis of my whakapapa stems from the teaching of the Tainui Waka through the generations to a tupuna called Koroki, who Ngāti Koroki take their name from the base of Maunga Tautari Mountain to the sides of the Waikato River to the expanse of the land around, in and around the Waikato. And so Rahui Papa is my name. Born and bred in Tokoroa, and had a unshakable association with my marae at Pohara, just south of Cambridge. My old people saw into the future and could see that our paepae would be devastated in time, and so they took some of us under their wings as their succession plan, and teaching us about the ways of our ancestry, and the knowledge and the skill sets that they had. Later on, I became a part and parcel of the inaugural setting up of the Waikato Tainui machine after the settlement in 1995. I became one of the younger members of Te Kauhanga Nui at that time, which was the Tainui Parliament. Later on, becoming part of the executive, and then even later still, chairing the executive of Waikato Tainui for some years. After stepping down in 2017, I then became the sole negotiator for Waikato Tainui, and now it's outstanding claims, principally based around the four harbours on the west coast and other areas within Tainui. I also, I'm also part and parcel of the National Iwi Chairs Forum as the co-chair with Dame Nada Glavish for the pūtangata, or the social aspects of the tribe. I am an adherent of the Kingitanga and a spokesperson for the King and the Kingitanga at various events, alongside others. And really, that's the makeup of the traditional knowledge that I've been blessed to be associated with. In our whakapapa and history, we talk about volcanoes, or puia, or whakaari. And so puia and whakaari are not necessarily just volcanoes. It's really the heat of the earth. So ruapehupehu in some parts of Tainui Waka. And principally with the central plateau around Taupo Nui Ātia with Tongariro. In our history, Taupiri Maunga also lived in the central plateau and grew up with her with a close whanaungatanga with Tongariro and the other sort of mountains of the central plateau. I'll talk about a little bit about that when we talk about Ru Whenua, or earthquakes, because it's more pertinent to that. But the close association with the Maunga and the mountains has been something that has really been prolific in our history. I mean, from the Taupō eruption, we know that around the Kihikihi area is a solid rock just standing by itself, and it's called Te Tokahaere. And we believe that that tupuna came from Taupo. And so in our histories and in our stories, it's about telling a story that will be pretty much backed up by science in time. And we talk about these tupuna traveling, and actually the story about Te Toka Haere is the art of flight. And so when our tupuna talked about Te Rere Mai o Te Toka Haere, or the flying here of Te Toka Haere, they're talking about a volcanic eruption and some of those rocks being moved over to here. Just in our northern type areas is the area of Tāmaki Makaurau as well. That's part and parcel of the Tainui Waka area and others as well. And we know that there are volcanic cones, and our tupuna used to live around those volcanic cones because in their view, the ground was fertile for the growth of food. And so it became that sort of fertility that gravitated our people to them, notwithstanding the fact that they were quite high up and they were made pretty good defensive power as well. And a lot of those stories, or those puia and those whakaari, see the subterranean river type streams coming up at places like Waingaro, where the hot springs and things are, right out to the Kawhia coast on the beach at Kawhia. They call it Te Puia, and because you dig down and you can create hot pools in the sand, and it's all about that subterranean volcanic activity that is happening there. Those are our sort of main stories. Each name, though, like Maunga Kia Kia or One Tree Hill, like and others, have particular stories unto themselves. We talk about an ancestor called Matāho. And Matāho was a giant who, so the head of Matāho is Mangere Mountain, which is a puia. And then Ngā Tapuwai, the footprints of Matāho, is around in the Mangere area. And te ihu o Matāho is an island in the Manukau Harbour. And we talk about that tupuna because that was the tupuna that was closely associated with volcanoes, with puia and whakaari in Aorohe.
The Waikato area is like the Rotorua Taupo area, you know, the hot springs and the volcanoes and stuff. And in fact, the Coromandel Peninsula through into the Hauraki Lowlands, and that is actually the abandoned old Taupo volcanic zone. So if we go back 2 to 10 million years ago, the Rotorua Taupo area is the modern-day Coromandel Peninsula, Hauraki Lowlands area, hence the hot springs and volcanic rocks and volcanic landforms that are remaining in the Waikato. One of the consequences of the Taupo volcanic zone is our large-scale geothermal systems, and New Zealand has been world-leading in utilising those to make electricity, so we have a lot of large power plants. The first one was Wairakei, which was, you know, the second one in the world. And that, from that, we have learned a lot of lessons. And one is that the consequence of developing these geothermal systems is that we destroy the surface features, and the surface features have a lot of values associated with them for the iwi community and, you know, people in general. We have those beautiful crystal clear, often called champagne pools, and the geysers. And that's when the primary deep geothermal fluid is coming straight to the surface. It feeds those pools. The other type of pool we have is when that geothermal fluid comes up, mixes with the groundwater, that makes an acid solution. And then we get the beautiful coloured pools, the greens, the yellows and the blues and different colours. And those are from chemical reactions in those pools between the groundwater and the geothermal water. So those are our sort of mixed or secondary type pools. And the third type of feature we have is associated with the heat, the steam coming up. That steam is mixing with the groundwater, that's making an acid solution. That acid solution is eating the soil, making clays, and that turns into our mud pools and our mud pots. So we have to think about this now, you know, when we utilise a geothermal system, do we make power or do we preserve the surface geothermal features? Sometimes when you go into the field, we take a thermometer with us so that we can measure the temperature, and occasionally you'll break your thermometer. But you can still actually ballpark the temperatures of a geothermal feature. If you put your hand into it and it feels cold, well, then you know it's less than your blood temperature, so you'll be in the high 20s, 30s degrees sort of mark. If it feels about the same as you, you're in the high 30s. And then up to about 50 degrees, you can put your hand into it. 40, 45, you can put your hand in, you can hold it for a second or two and go, oh yeah, that's getting hot, I better pull it out. By 50 degrees, you sort of go, oh damn, I shouldn't have done that. And then when you get to the 60, 70 degrees, you can kiss the surface of the water with your fingers. You can sort of touch it and go, yep, that's really hot. I shouldn't really have been doing that. So you can actually sort of ballpark, is it temperature low 30s? Is it 30s to 40s? Not comfortable, but you can put your hand into it. And then 60s and 70s, it's, that was a little bit hot. I shouldn't have done that. So you can actually ballpark the temperatures and get an idea just by using your finger. In the volcanic environment, particularly in an environment like Tongariro National Park or Mount Tarawera, where you're running the scree slopes or something like that, you need to remember these are what we call fresh rocks. They're young rocks. They're very, very angular and they have lots of sharp corners on them. So you can get cut if you fall over or slip or trip. Those rocks are going to cut you. So you're going to get some sort of abrasion when you fall over. So you need to be very aware of your footing in that environment because, the rocks are young, they're very angular, they've got lots of sharp corners on them, and they will cut you. Being in the outdoor environment in New Zealand, the climate changes is the big one. Particularly getting wet and cold, that the weather can change very fast and you can go from a quite pleasant environment into a wet and damp environment where hypothermia becomes your enemy. That can happen. The other is if you take on the big climbs, the Taranakis, the Narahoes, Ruapehus, you're starting to get up to moderate to high altitudes. You're getting above 7,000 feet, you're getting close into 9,000 feet at Ruapehu. So you're starting to get into that area where altitude starts to impact on you. The air's a little bit thinner and it's a little bit harder. And I've certainly noticed if I walk up Mount Ruapehu for a day's work, I'm much more acclimatised than if I get flown up. If I fly up, jump out of the helicopter, pick up a spade and start digging a hole, I'm puffing and panting and stuffed. Whereas if I've walked up the volcano, I'm acclimatised a lot better for that day. Living in the Rotorua Taupo area, working in Tongariro National Park, it's a dynamic area. There are a lot of hazards associated with it. You have the earthquake hazard, you have the volcano hazard, and they're sometimes superimposed on top of each other. But the thing you have to remember, these are all sort of long return periods that the volcanic eruptions from the cone volcanoes of Tongariro National Park, they're somewhere between a decade and five decades return period. So you may only experience, one or two of those in your lifetime, sort of because they've got such long return periods. The caldera volcanoes, their return periods are hundreds of years to thousands of years. So there's a very, very high chance you'll never experience one of those in your lifetime. You may experience volcanic unrest from one of those caldera volcanoes, which will be manifested as primarily as earthquakes. So you might feel a swarm of earthquakes or something like that. And the other aspect of being in the Rotorua Taupo area is the rifting. So you have earthquakes, and then on a return period of maybe between 1 and 300 years, you'll have the large-scale earthquakes like the Edgecombe earthquake. So there's lots of myths and misconceptions with respect to volcanic hazards. And one in particular that I've encountered many, many times as working in Tongariro National Park are the hazards particularly associated with Mount Ruapehu. Mount Ruapehu is incredibly well mitigated. We know where the hazards are. Like the summit hazard zone is defined by the Department of Conservation. That's an area within 2 or 3 kilometres of the Crater Lake. That's a no-go area. We know where the lahar paths are, where the lahars flow down the side of the volcano. Therefore, all of the infrastructure has been removed or engineered to handle lahars. And in fact, the safest places on Mount Ruapehu during an eruption are in the ski lodges. those are incredibly safe places. They're well out of the Lahar Pass, they're well out of the ballistic zones, etc. So in fact, returning to the ski lodge and being in the ski lodge and not packing up and leaving the volcano in a hurry is something that people should be aware of. It's actually a good place to be. Another misconception we often encounter in talking about and communicating about volcanoes is the translation of the behaviour of a cone volcano and a caldera volcano. Two very distinctive types of volcano, very distinctive types of eruptions. So Mount Ruapehu, for example, might be undergoing a period of unrest, and then somebody in the community will start talking about, you know, the Taupo eruption 232 AD and how Ruapehu may do that. Ruapehu is a cone volcano. It will never, ever do what Taupo did in 232 AD. They're chalk and cheese. It does not happen. Another area where the public struggle to understand volcanic processes is the time frames involved in going from volcanic unrest to a volcanic eruption. So if you take a caldera volcano like Taupo or Tarawera or Okataina, those volcanoes will go through decades, many, many decades of volcanic unrest in the process of preparing themselves to think about having an eruption. So you may experience ground deformation, you may experience swarms of earthquakes. Just because those are occurring does not mean an eruption is imminent. When a volcanic eruption is imminent, we're talking about the molten material that's going to be erupted. That typically accumulates at sort of 5 or 8 kilometres depth in the crust. As the eruption comes closer, that material starts migrating to the surface, and eventually it has to reach the surface to generate the eruption. Now, that process is not always very fast. It may take hours or days. If you're talking about volcanic unrest being generated at 5 or 8 kilometres depth, that's just the molten material just rolling over and having a restless sleep. It's not actually thinking about getting up out of bed and going for a run or something like that, which is the eruption. So there's time scales involved in the process of moving the material to the surface. And our conversations with the community, if we were closer to an eruption, would be very, very different than the ones that we have during unrest. If you're close to a cone volcano's active vent, there is very little, if no, indications that a volcanic explosion is about to occur. You can be standing on a crater rim, looking into a crater and going, oh wow, look at that big hole, look at the steam coming out, and 3 or 4 seconds later, it will be an eruption. Right up to that initiation of the eruption, you don't see anything that screams out, all hell's going to break loose in a few seconds. The best mitigation for, you know, dealing with volcanic hazards near active vents is not to be there. You need to be aware that going within, say, 3 or 4 kilometres of an active volcano, that's one where the volcanic alert level is at level 2, where there's moderate to heightened volcanic unrest occurring, the best mitigation is not to be there.
This is the end of part 1. Featured on this episode, in order of appearance, Ngāti Tūwhare Toa's Bob Smith, GNS Science Lead Scientist for Natural Hazard and Risk, Graham Leonard, GNS Science Volcanologist, Brad Scott, Director and Senior Social Scientist for Canary Innovation and Co-Chair of the World Meteorological Organizational High Impact Weather Project, Sally Potter, Volcanologist and Science Communicator, Dr. Janine Krippner, Massey University Group Leader, Earth Sciences, Professor in Natural Hazards, John Proctor, and Waikato Tainui's Rahui Papa. For more information, check out the links on our show notes page at waikatocivildefense.govt.nz/podcast. Produced and directed by Drew Mertens. Production partner, LeBlue. Copyright 2024, Waikato Civil Defense Emergency Management Group.